That's the motor with the gasoline and the cylinder. By the time it gets there, when you've adjusted the knobs correctly, he sees no bivouac. The tube sees a pure resistance. If the tube wants to see 1,000 ohms, you force the tube to see 1,000 ohms of resistance. I'm not counting the capacitance of the tube itself. I'm keeping this simple. So, you force the bivouac to be zero, and it's really made up of both common mode and differential mode. So, Wyndham is a slightly more complicated antenna, but if we're smart enough step by step, I say we can analyze it and understand it, though, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is
K2KEY.
Now, mathematically, when we were talking about so-called three-state antenna, we were talking about an antenna wired closely state. The theory is that it was infinitely thin. Now coming back down to Earth, when we put up a dipole, what happens if we the wavelength to diameter ratio? Now, I remember that you see that a lot of advertisements that they use to pretty stretched for hot work, hot drawn copper. And then one says, well, our antenna is superior, but we're using number 10. The other one says, number 12, not good, whatever. What happens with the, in real world, with the wavelength to diameter ratio, how does that really affect the situation at the feed point? Is it really a criteria over?
It's a yes and a no to that one, Mel. Do you own any issue of a book called Antenna Engineering Handbook? Do you own any issue of that, Mel?
Of course.
Which issue do you own? What's the latest issue you own?
Well, it's an antique. It's way back, quite a number of years back, most likely. I'd say 25 years ago, easily over.
Okay. Is the front cover a deep maroon cover of a McGraw-Hill book? It's a 1961 issue.
I think that's a brownish, I think, cover. Right, yeah, I think you're right.
Okay. The reason I ask that is the first issue is in Chapter 3. And all later issues is in Chapter 4. Go to the graph called 3-3 in Chapter 3 and 3-4. Graph 3-3 shows you all the resistive components for every length and every diameter of monopole wire you ever want to build. 3-4 shows you the reactants for every length and every diameter of every monopole you want to build. All rated versus wavelength, or versus degrees of wavelength, so to speak. So, if you want to know the exact number, and somebody went through a lot of effort of documenting all that, I think it was done by the Wheeler Laboratory, but I'm not sure. To answer your question, the resistive component, as a function of making the wire fatter and fatter, the resistive component changes very slowly. The reactive component changes more rapidly. However, if your wire of a monopole is 90 degrees, is 85 degrees long, including capacitance effect, 90 degrees electronic, but 85 degrees mechanical, which is 170 degrees for a dipole, 85 degrees for a monopole. If it is approximately a quarter wavelength long, for almost all diameters, the reactance goes to zero. As you make it fat and skinny, and you go away from the quarter wavelength and length, the reactance moves more slowly or more rapidly, depending on diameter. It's all been documented. And now you're about to ask, why does it do that? And the answer is, as the dipole in free space gets fatter and fatter, the signal traveling down the wire doesn't have to go straight. He's now got the ability to go off at a slant a little bit because the wire is so fat. He can find, by going off a slant, a slightly different way of staying in step or out of step. So the rate of getting reactive, the rate of getting out of step, slows down in general when the wire is fatter. That's a fancy way of saying a fatter dipole is more broadband. Those curves will show it to you. The slanted current flow approach, as opposed to going right down the axis of the wire, is one of the explanations as why it acts that way. I could also approach it another way and say that a SATA wire has a different number of nanohenries per inch. But we're really saying the same thing, just from two different points of view. K2KUY, K2LIW.
Roger, this is K2KUY. Yeah, I'm looking at the reactive on the person, real on. Why and what? They have to cut this little short through this. This is a very interesting subject. As the spiral is going inward, I see, what is this 377 ohms? Is that the theoretical intrinsic impedance of space, really, Dick? Is that true? Over.
Hold on now. You may be looking at the wrong graph now. Are you looking at 3-3, which is the resistive component, and graph 3-4, which is the reactive component? The graph I'm talking about is an XY graph where degrees are the horizontal axis and ohms of either resistance or positive or negative reactance is the vertical axis. And the graphs on there, is it 3-3 and 3-4 that you're looking at now? You may be looking at a different graph. There's another graph where it looks like a spiral. That's not the graph I'm talking about. That's another way of displaying, and that takes a little bit more difficulty to understand it. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm all right. I looked at the other one now. Yeah, I see what you're talking about. No, I was looking at the spiral graph also, the 3-3. The spiral. No, I just happened to notice on the spiral graph you're looking at. What is that, the spiral at? It seems to go to 300 and some odd, 377 ohms. Is that really the true impedance of free space? Stick over.
Stand by for a second. I'm opening my book right now.
377 is the true impedance characteristic of free space.
Yeah, that's true, but it's not what the wire is seeing. It's what he's asking. And that's a much more complicated question.
That's what I'm asking. 377. You see what I'm saying? How does that figure into the situation, over?
Okay. I see the 3-3 and the 3-4. I'm looking for the spiral graph you're looking at, which I think is a later one. Where's the spiral graph? Where in the world? What's the graph number of the spiral you're looking at?
When I got the book and realized somebody spilled something into this book, that's why I figured the guy's so cheap. I think it's this figure 6 over.
You think it's 3-6? Okay. I'm looking at the fourth edition. You're looking at the first edition. And I thought that chapter 3 became chapter 4 in the later editions. I'm looking at chapter 4. And I thought they left that chapter pretty much alone. I've seen the spiral graph you're talking about many times, but I'm not seeing it in the fourth edition. But by the way, the main graph, 3-3 and 3-4, in the first edition, which is 4-3 and 4-4 in all later issues. You guys who don't have that book in front of you, and it's a $130 book, you can get it free of charge, those graphs, by going to WA1MBA.org, www.WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha.org. That's the so-called microwave website of WA1MBA, Tom Williams. You go to the bottom of that page and you'll see the K2RIW dipole information. And you'll also see those two graphs we're talking about. So you can get these graphs free of charge. And you'll notice that on the resistive one, in your book, now 3-3, you'll see that to the left of 90 degrees, which is the left of quarter wavelength long for a monopole, all of those lines merge together. You get a certain amount of resistance that doesn't matter very much with diameter. When you start getting longer than a quarter wavelength on each half of the dipole, then you start getting those different lines on the right-hand side of the graph. They go to different altitudes depending on whether the wire is skinny or fat. So the resistive component makes a big difference as you go beyond quarter wavelength of each side of the dipole, or the length of the monopole. When you look at 3-4 in your book, 4-4 for all other editions, and you look at around 85 degrees, you notice that all the lines go through 0 ohms of reactance. So whether it's a fat dipole or a skinny dipole, you make it the right length, they all have the exact same length of resonance, which is kind of crazy. However, you notice that the skinny wires change reactance much more rapidly, much bigger slope. The fat wires almost become flat in that region. And the reason they become flat is that I'm saying that the signal going down a fat wire doesn't have to go straight down the center. It can go up at an angle and still find the right length to keep them happy so that all the bounces stay in step. And for some reason I don't completely understand, he chooses to do that. So fatter antennas are full broadband. That's what these curves are telling us. The fatter antennas on the resistive curve are the ones closer to the bottom of the page. The fatter curve on the reactance curve are the ones that are almost more parallel across the center of the graph. So fatter dipoles are more broadband. Fatter dipoles,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Fatter dipoles pick up reactance much more slowly as you sweep away from resonant frequency. KQKUN, KQLAW.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, I'm looking at that. That's very thin and thick. I see what's happening there. That is, you know, is that have anything to do with strictly frequency? I mean, is this really across the board really a factor, a dick, or am I saying I'm knocking myself out by spending a lot of money for heavy wire, say, at 80 meters over?
Okay, if I built my 80-meter dipole out of 18-gauge wire, 14-gauge wire, or 6-gauge wire, even though that wire, as far as amps it can carry, and the weight of all of that 131 feet of wire in my hand makes a huge difference. One case is a lot of heavy copper. In either of those cases with an 80-meter dipole, you're still talking about 1,000 to 1 and 500 to 1 ratio of diameter to wavelength. So you're in the very skinny, you're in the very steep slopes of these curves. And, and you're changing so slowly compared to wavelength. On 80 meters, it doesn't matter. On 2 meters, you now can use large diameter tubing or small diameter tubing. In wavelength, now you're really moving. And things are happening. You can make a very fat dipole in 2 meters out of using a caged wire or fatter tubing or whatever. And by the way, even on 80 meters, you can make, radio-wise, you can make a fat piece of wire. I can make a piece of wire 1 foot in diameter by setting up 3 wires in a triangular pattern, if you know what I mean. The radio wave won't see those fine little details that your eye sees. It'll think that's a fat dipole. So by putting 3 wires parallel with little cage holding devices every 2 feet, I can force my dipole without using a whole lot of copper to be as fat as you like, and therefore you can get these low slope curves if that's what you want. And every one of these curves, the horizontal axis is in degrees. That's degrees of wavelength. All of those curves work whether you're working at 1,000 meg or 1 meg. In either case, you can calculate what 360 degrees is, what is a wavelength, and you can enter that curve. And because Mother Nature is so happy to do scaling, if I took my 80-meter dipole and changed every dimension by the exact ratio of 80 meters to 1,000 megahertz, I'll get the exact same performance as long as I scale all the dimensions. That's why these graphs are in degrees. The frequency doesn't matter once you calculate the degrees, which really means wavelength. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Hey, you're saying to me if we build one of these so-called cage antennas, and use a, even with that, we use a good, heavy, 10 wire, 8 wire, whatever. According then to this, this type of antenna will give us the most chance if we're going to make, the most accurate measurements we can possibly do. In other words, we're going to try to get to this so-called beautiful 70 ohm point. And this type of antenna will bring us in close, Mike, because, like you say, I mean, you can't take a piece of wire 10 inches in diameter, you know. So you say we can achieve the same thing by making a cage. So this is the only way that if theoretically we want to get to that precise 70 ohm point. Am I correct? Over.
Negatory. Let's look at figure 3-3 now. Bear in mind that these graphs are for a monopole. Bear in mind that a dipole is a pair of monopoles back to back. Dipole wants to be half wavelength long, which is around 180 degrees. The half dipole, the monopole, wants to be around 90 degrees. So look at graph 3-3. Look at 90 degrees, which is near the bottom of the damn graph. And it's to the right of the 75 and to the left of the 100. You look at the 90 degree point, and you trace yourself over to the left, you'll be at 35 ohms. So a monopole, a quarter wavelength long, has a resistance component, 35 ohms. When you make a monopole to the right and a monopole to the left, two monopoles back to back, you double the distance. You're nearly 90 degrees, becomes nearly 180 in your head, not on the graph. The 35 ohms to the left and 35 ohms to the right, they're in series. It becomes 70 or 72, so it's 36 ohms. It's not easy to read, but that's telling you 36 ohms for 90 degrees of length. That's half of the solution, if you know what I mean. So the 72 ohms, you're looking at it there, Mel. I'll admit it's a coded message. Now back to you.
WDL repeater system. You know, I'm trying to focus this out. For what I see, in other words, I think that I try to get one or two or mail it, but it seems that if I had, the thick antenna with a heavy wire, that the resistive component at a halfway resonance will be closest to 70 ohms if we use this heavy clunker thing, over.
Negative. I can make the dipole as skinny as I want out of 40 gauge wire. And if I make sure the wire has no resistance to it, I will be getting damn close to 72 ohms for a full dipole. If I make it out of fat wire, I'll get 69 ohms. The resistive component moves very slowly. If you look at the 75 degree, if you look at the 75 degree point, in reality 90 degrees is a little bit over to the right. You look at the 75 degree point, fat and thin all come together. The resistive component changes very slowly. You might as well make it skinny. The only advantage you get from the fat dipole is when you look at curve 3-4 in your book, you'll see that the fat curves are much more parallel as they go through zero reactive, the vertical axis of the chart. Whereas the skinny dipoles are the ones that have the steep slope. So, without a doubt, a fatter dipole is broader in bandwidth. It's broader in bandwidth because the reactive component moves very slowly. That's what that 3-4 is telling you. The curves are more parallel for the fat wire when it comes to reactive. The resistive component doesn't matter. A skinny dipole at resonance is going to be 72 ohms. And you'll notice on the reactive curve, 3-4, at 90 degrees, every one of the lines goes to zero. When the dipole is the resonant length, they all have no reactive. Fat, skinny, doesn't matter. The advantage of fat is that it goes away from 72 ohms resistive more slowly if it's fat. The reactive component moves more slowly if it's fat. K2KEY, K2LIW.
QIQ for comment?
QIQ, start off with your name, sir. I should know it.
It's a nickname, Glenn. Just a quick question about that. I'm just wondering now, the thickness of the wire, doesn't that affect the efficiency of the antenna because of the ratio between, the launch resistance as opposed to the radius resistance in terms of, efficiency value for the antenna?
Yes, it does, Glenn. When I take my glass of water and pour it into the ocean, the tide is now a little bit higher. If I use thin wire or thick wire, there is a difference in my efficiency of my antenna. One case is 99% efficient, the other case is 89.9% efficient. Changes very slowly. Yeah, there's skin effect, and if I had super skinny wire, if I made the dipole out of 40 gauge wire, the ohms per foot is going to kill me on an 80 meter dipole. I'm going to give you on that one. But for any a diameter of wire that Glenn is likely to use, in order for it to be fat enough so it can physically keep itself together and not fall apart, and can still support the weight of the coax cable coming off the dipole, or the open wire line coming up, support the transmission line. For you to choose any reasonable diameter wire that will support its transmission line, this is probably true of almost every band, you're likely to do it. You're automatically into the range of wire diameter where the resistance of the wire is a second order effect and maybe it's a tertiary effect. Once your wire has negligible resistance compared to the 72 ohms, the impedance of the dipole is 72 ohms. If your resistive component of your wire is 1 ohm, you're sitting in the ocean. It doesn't matter. The difference is small. Don't worry about it. You choose the wire diameter for physical reasons, not electrical reasons. Now, once that dipole is working like it's supposed to, and it has some reasonable strength, therefore reasonable diameter, therefore reasonably small resistive component, by definition, it is nearly 100% efficient. Of all the energy you put into it, there's only three things it can do. Reflect some of it back to the transmitter, and by your tuning of your antenna tuner, you made the VISRA go away, so it stops doing that. The second thing it can do is it can burn it up into resistance, but your resistive component's not very big. That's doing much of that. And the third component, it radiates it into space. So any reasonable antenna you and I are likely to make one of this manner has to have so close to 100% efficiency for being academic when we discuss it. That's an opinion. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with you on most of the other tricycle antennas. The only place I've ever found it to be a problem is when I was working on a 80 meter and 160 meter antenna that's a very, very thin gauge wires, which I wanted to use. I just found it consistent percentage of the antenna, because on the dipole, when I was measuring the resistance over the length, I was getting, ohms, up as high as even like 10 ohms on very thin gauge wire. And when I popped it up to like 16 gauge wire, then it got down to like just an ohm or so. And then I could, live with that, and then it was just going as a matching piece, was like 73, so it wasn't a real big deal. And then after that, it was really just more of in my loop antenna, just going with the single turn loop as opposed to, I was trying multiple turn loops, so I found like the RAC. So I'd be a lot there with the efficiency, but going back to the single turn loop, I was much better off. But I know what you're saying, but I think on the 80 meter and 160, on full length antenna, you may have to just keep an eye on the resistance of the wire, because it might be higher than you think.
I hear you. Were you using very fine gauge wire and an 80 meter dipole because you were trying to make it optically invisible?
Absolutely. I was using magnetic wires that you normally wind the transformers with, where the insulation is just that magnetic coating on the outside. And I was using, a 20 gauge wire. And when I measured after, I got out to almost like 400 feet trying to make the loop antenna, I was like, oh boy, the resistance was a little bit higher than I thought it was, than I really expected.
Yep, I understand you. And that's a fairly extreme case you've got there, Glenn, where you used very fine gauge wire either to make it invisible or you thought you would get more efficiency out of multiple turns. And a lot of people think that. Once you resonate the radiating system, its physical size almost doesn't matter. You ask any amateur on 20 meters any day, if I take an 80 meter dipole that's supposed to be 130 feet long, and I've made it out of 14 gauge wire, so resistance is not a problem, and I start making the dipole shorter and shorter, supposed to be 130, I do an experiment of 100, and I put an antenna tuner near the antenna and re-resonate it, and then I go to 80 feet, then I go to 60 feet, then I go to 40 feet, and I go to 30 feet, and if my antenna tuner will tolerate it, when I get down to 30 feet instead of 130 feet, and I'm able to re-resonate it, narrow band is all hell, but I've resonated at the 3800, that's where I'm transmitting. What do you believe is the efficiency? What do you believe is the gain when I make the dipole one quarter or one eighth of the normal length, but I re-resonate it? What's your guess on that one, Glenn?
Well, I usually like to calculate these things, but what would scare me about using an antenna shorter than one quarter wavelength, even though I was able to tune it with an antenna sooner, is some of the problems you were talking about earlier, that all of a sudden the other components in the system start radiating other than just my antenna. And there again, now that starts going back to this radiation efficiency issue. And now what's doing the radiant is my radiating elements that I want these are going to be from, or is it actually my transmission line? That's really my only concern there. But let me let you continue with what's supposed to be the...
Okay, for the transmission line to be radiating, that only happens when you've got common mode current on the transmission line. So if you keep the transmission line, in my silly example, 72 ohm twin lead in the center of the dipole, and there is no common mode current, therefore the transmission line acts like it's perfectly shielded, and it's not radiating. Even though I made the dipole super small, as long as my antenna tuner can bring it back into resonance, I'm not radiating by anything but the wire of the dipole. And assume that my antenna tuner is lossless, and for the time being, assume that my twin lead is lossless. Yeah, the twin lead has got more and more vis-wire on it, and the currents on it are getting higher, and it's got a little extra loss because of that. But I'm using quality twin leads, and we'll assume it doesn't have loss. But I've now got a dipole, one quarter or one eighth the normal length, but I've re-resonated it. What do you think is the capture area? What do you think is the gain of that foreshortened dipole? Back to you, Glenn.
I'm really not sure. The only thing that I've ever experimented in that area with making the antenna shorter is mostly just like modeling in MathCAD. And there again, some of the concerns that I had with the antenna shorter than quarter wavelength is that, you know, at one quarter wavelength, I've got a voltage maxima across the voltage not to be incurred at the true or radiation. So at 90 degrees or halfway to 180, I have two maximums supporting the antenna at that point. When they start getting shorter, more like becoming fractions of the quarter wavelength, now I'm not really seeing the true voltage maximum across the radius, you know, which is what I'm seeing like models. And what was concerned there is that, well, if the radiation pattern isn't reaching maximum across the length of the radiator, then there's some distortion in the wave itself, leaving the antenna, which might come back to efficiency then, because it might start turning into loading as opposed to real efficiency, but there again, I'm not sure.
Okay, I can see what you've done with your modeling, and you've also done computer-generated graphics with animation. I can see what you've done. I can see how you've used good common sense, and you've come to a good conclusion. And your conclusion is very pessimistic, Glenn. Mother Nature is much nicer and more friendly to you on this particular one. You believed you had to have the two voltage maxima at the tip of the antenna and a near minimum at the center in order to get the normal dipole maximum radiation efficiency. Good common sense. Not true. If you open up Krause's book on antennas, 1950 McGraw-Hill, that's the first edition, and he's got a second and third edition. If you read the section on the infinitesimal dipole, as the dipole gets smaller and smaller and smaller, it gets highly capacitive reactive. And the resistive component goes to very small numbers. 72 ohms will go down to 2 ohms. And the reactive component goes to 10,000 ohms, a big number. But your antenna tuner is handling that. Once your impedance match that infinitesimal dipole, the donut pattern of the dipole becomes a little bit fatter. You lose half a dB of gain. 2.14 dB goes down to 1.76, I think. That's it. The exact same gain, almost the exact same pattern, almost the exact same efficiency if you've done a good enough job of impedance matching. Opposite of common sense. So since it's got the same gain, let me drop a second. Since it's got the same gain, it has, within half a dB, it's got the exact same effective capture area within half a dB. And your next question is going to be, hey, Nathan, you're crazy. How the hell can something that small have almost the same capture area? Well, that's what happens when this huge reactant is being impedance matched by your antenna tuner. The voltage on the antenna climbs sky high. maybe the tip of the antenna when it was a full half wave, the tip voltage used to be 1,000 volts for 100 watt spindle. I don't know the exact number, but I'm using a concept here. Assume it was 1,000 volts at the tip for a full half wave dipole. And now you make it an eighth wavelength, an eighth of that size. The 1,000 volts at the tip is now 18,000 volts. You're getting dangerously close to the point where the dipole starts arcing to space or arcing between the two sides. It's that extreme increase in voltage that's now doing the radiating. I will admit that when you're in the first quarter wavelength in space away from the antenna pattern is going to look a little bit crazy up close. But that's not where the guy you're talking to is. The guy you're talking to is a whole lot of wavelengths away. Mother Nature straightens that all out. It looks like an ordinary TEM transmission once it really gets out into space. But the peculiarity of the infinitesimal dipole is that it becomes very narrowband in BizWAP bandwidth. But if you're smart enough to do a good job of impedance matching, you've only lost half a dB. Opposite of very common, any reasonable common sense. Of course it sounds crazy. But once you understand the concept, there are ways you can use it. I am using that professionally in my consulting business, and I make money doing that, Glenn. KC2QIQ, KQLIW.
KQHW, there with a comment, Dick.
Hold on, let Glenn talk first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Very good, Dick. I appreciate it's not an area where I have certainly a lot of experience, and it's something that I've been playing with mostly lately, and I try to model this stuff to get a better understanding of it. And I'm listening to you explain this every week, and I go back and I dabble with it here and there. But the only other question I still have on top of that, you don't have to answer it right away, we'll pick up the other person, but it's just that when you have the antenna where the voltage on a very, very small radius starts increasing, doesn't that in itself start causing efficiency issues? In other words, if you have a matching network now that has to make this extreme match, and it was like, when I look at like 1-to-1 balance, and I look at the losses in that, sometimes I can get them very, very low. When I go from 4-to-1, losses there again are a little bit higher. When I start getting into like a 9-to-1, you kind of see the direction that I'm going. In other words, if I have to make this exotic matching network, aren't we losing losses there as well? The potential records for break station.
No, you're absolutely right. Let me drop it. As I start making an impedance matching network to take this highly capacitive reactive antenna with a very small amount of resistance, and I impedance match it, internal to my impedance matching network, I'm also building up great big voltages. And now what is the equivalent series resistance of the capacitor of my impedance matching network? What's the equivalent series resistance of the Q of the coil, the inductor, into my matching network? I've now got to be very careful how I choose those components. If I take ordinary 0402 surface mount components and build this thing out of it, I would have smoke and flames in no time. It'd be a beautiful experiment in high energy physics. So I'm talking about theory now, and I'm trying to understand antenna concepts. Yeah, there's a reality here. It becomes more and more difficult to make that impedance matching network, and you're dead on. But if you're smart enough, there are ways of doing it, like great big pieces of coax cable. I mean, the highest Q inductor that Mel has ever built was the right wavelength of a piece of coaxial cable with a short circuit or an open circuit at the end of it. That's a nearly lossless inductor. When he builds that out of RG8U coax, RG214, or if he really wants to get serious, and he goes to 7/8 inch hardline or inch and 5/8 hardline, all that resistance goes to zero. Yeah, physically the thing becomes a little unwieldy. You're not going to squeeze that into a cigarette pack. But there are ways of synthesizing those inductors and those capacitors of that really hard-working impedance matching network. If you try hard enough, you can find ways of making it lossless. Therefore, the gain comes back, even though the antenna is nearly infinitesimal in length. Now, this is an interesting science experiment. Is it practical? Well, you build an antenna like that on 80 meters, and the darn thing may be 3 kilohertz wide. Your QSY 6KC, and you got to retune your antenna a whole lot. It's got a lot of problems. But if for some particular reason you're forced into a very small volume of space, and you've got to get an antenna, Mother Nature, if you're smart enough, will let you do it. You got to think out of the box, though.
Okay, this is KEY. Yeah, well, Dick, what I'm alluding to, really,
that as you get the thinner wire or spreading it out, what is happening really is that the cube of the thinner wire, or as you go to long length, is going higher. So the experiment that he was alluding to that I did, I have a less than a 0.1 wavelength loop antenna that I use on 75 meters. I mean, you've been using it basically as a receiving antenna. I have put power into it, used as a transmitting antenna. But of course, conditions on 75 meters are so noisy, I usually have to run, you know, power. So I am not going to try to pump a kilowatt plus into that loop that's next to me. First of all, I don't think the variable capacitors and components there that I put together are hefty enough for that. But I surely have proved that my inside loop in many cases exceeds the outside loop, which is 272 feet in diameter and is 45 feet above ground. I know that holds a lot of people and I have people that I'm losing my mind, but I have done that experiment and it worked. Let me see if Dick is back.
Yes, he's finally back. What I did was to overload my transmitter, I overheated it. There we go. Overheated the transmitter until it comes back to normal operation. Let's see if I can. Nope, hasn't cooled off yet. So I'm on a handy charger right now, but this handy charger's been for quite a bit of time. You've got a big battery on it. You're right. Mel's been running a very small loop in wavelength. That dipole I've been talking about, Glenn, can be very small in wavelength. And if you're smart enough to do the impedance matching, you're right back to the exact same radiation efficiency, which is hard to believe. The efficiency can still be near 100% if you're smart enough in the way you design that impedance matching network. And the antenna pattern gets just a little bit fatter. The dipole donut pattern gets a little bit fatter. And you are only half a dB down from the full half-wave dipole. And of course, it's very different than common sense, but just very slowly, I think I can make you believe it. I've been doing that in some extreme circumstances on electrically small antennas that we were forced to do professionally. And what I had to do in order to evaluate when we do get losses, and you're right, we get loss of the impedance matching network, and because of the very high voltages on the antenna, we can get loss of the antenna itself. And how do you find those losses? You got two approaches. Let me drop. Technique number one is you put 20 watts into the antenna for 10 minutes, turn up the transmitter and walk over there real fast, put your hand on everything and find out where it's hot. The only way you can get inefficiency of an antenna is by burning up the RF energy into heat. Something's got to get hot. And if you can't put that much power into it, or if the antenna is so small and delicate, you can't do that experiment. The next thing we did, and we just started doing it a couple of weeks ago, beautiful experiment, go and get yourself a thermal imaging camera that can measure 1 degree Fahrenheit change in the material. And you start taking a picture with a thermal imaging camera, and you look at who's getting hot. Even if it's only 1 degree Fahrenheit, he's the guy that's eating up your energy. That's the guy that's eating your lunch. And you go over there and change that material. It's the wrong kind of plastic, or it's the wrong kind of copper, or whatever. The thing that gets hot, or the wrong kind of a matching capacitor, the thing that gets hot is the only thing that's wasting your efficiency. You cannot build a antenna that has no resistive loss, that is below isotropic in gain. One of the antennas we were experimenting with, Glenn, was minus 6 dB of measured gain on the resonant frequency. You can't build an antenna below isotropic. 6 dB is a 4-to-1 ratio. 75% of our power was going into the loss of a piece of plastic. We had to change from brand A of plastic to brand B. The minus 6 dB of gain went back to minus 0 dB over isotropic. It came back to where it should be, and the thermal imaging camera showed it to us. Real fun experiment. KT2QIQ, K2LIW.
One other question for you, though. Have you tried experiments with beams, with directional types of antennas, shrinking them down to That's certainly something I'm very interested in right now, and if there's anything I should look into, because need to match a shortened 10 through 20 meter beam and do the matching network right at the antenna. Something that's very desirable to do, but is there anything I should really watch out for? And also, the multi bandwidth at the same time.
Okay, when it comes to shrinking down an antenna, there's at least two ways of doing it, Glenn. You can take the individual elements and shrink their length by putting inductive loading coils, by zigzagging the elements, by putting top-loading capacitors on the ends of the elements. So the element length can be shrunk down. That you can do. When you shrink the boom length and try to keep the same number of elements the same, a couple of things happen. The Yagi has got energy flowing from the driven element to the first director to the second director by a combination of a coupling coefficient between those elements and a certain spatial length between those elements. As you change that length physically, you're increasing, you're lowering the phase shift between the elements, which is changing the design. And because the elements are getting closer, not only is the phase shift going lower, but the coupling coefficient is going higher. So now your parasitic elements have the wrong voltage at the wrong phase, and the gain goes away. There are ways of compensating that, and I've recently patented one of those ways. There are ways of getting a little bit of compensation on that. But in general, the length of the boom of a well-tuned Yagi is the gain. Mr. Yagi's expert in the world is Gunter Hahn, CL6WU. And if you look at his curve, and if you look at his equation, he's got an equation that will tell you what gain you can get out of any Yagi. The only thing you have to enter into the equation is how many wavelengths long is the boom. Wavelength to boom is gain, once you've done a good job of tuning the director strength. So, can you shrink down a Yagi? The answer is sort of, but not a whole lot. Does that make some sense, Glenn? Go ahead.
K2RAW. Yeah, Dick, I kind of suspect that because the antenna that I'm presently using is an NA5D Hushcraft, and it does use the loading coil, but it's using pass-and-pass, and I just haven't been really all that happy with the performance of it, and I'm trying to see if I can make some adjustments on it, and I recently bought an antenna analyzer, and I figure the next time I get up on the roof, hopefully next weekend, when it's prevailing, I'd like to start making a lot more adjustments to see if I can improve the directivity on it a little bit better, maybe a little bit more gain, and see if I can more bandwidth if I try some tricks.
Yeah, that was a fun experiment.
It
looks like my transmitter came back to life, and now at least you can hear me with a little bit of speech processing. Those are fun experiments to do. So, you're not going to get a lot of shrinking of a Yagi, in my opinion. Two-element Yagi, yeah, sort of. When you get up to three elements, you almost can't do any shrinking anymore without sacrificing the gain. Now, if you're very limited in space and you want to get the maximum possible gain, then you set the boom as long as you can get. And should you put three elements on that boom or fellow four elements on the boom, it's an interesting question to ask. And again, by the Gunter-Hahn curve, you can sort of get an answer to that. But don't expect to take a 10-foot-long Yagi, shrink it down to 5 feet, and get almost the same gain. There, it doesn't work. But if you had a 10-foot-long dipole, and you shrunk it down to 5 feet, can you get the same gain out of the dipole within 90-some-odd%? The answer is yes. Does that make some more sense?
Absolutely. And thanks again, Nick, because so many things I've been trying, and I might be able to try some other antennas as well. I'm also very interested in that Stepper IR antenna out there. I hear it's an excellent work on it, and for its size, it does a very, very interesting job. But certainly as far as the dipole goes and shrinking it down, I want to do some experiments there and measure, I'm pretty handy with making coupling circuits, so I'd like to see if I can make a nice match there in the cable or some short dipoles and see what I can do.
Before you get too far into the stepper, have a whole lot of fun by going to the website of Kilo 9 Lima November Sierra. Kilo 9 Lima November Sierra, a guy in Northern Illinois, we've got an array of six 40-meter Stepper Yagis all in one great big array. I hope by a Google search you can find Kilo 9 Lima November Sierra. If not, I can get you the website. And you've got the over 200 photographs of the assembly of this array. It's on 180 feet of Roan 85 tower. Its horizontal boom is, I think, 70 feet long, made out of Roan 65 tower. This vertical mast that holds three Yagis each is made out of Roan 55 tower. And this thing is tiltable in elevation and rotatable in azimuth. The whole antenna is about something like 80 feet wide and about 70 feet high. And it's got an array of six Yagis of the 40 element steppers. I wonder if you've seen that one, Glenn. Go ahead.
Breaking fish you recognize. No, I haven't seen it, but it's something I definitely want to look into. But just hearing some of these stepper IORs, certainly I wouldn't even be able to get to that probably until next spring. But I certainly want to experiment a little bit more with the antenna that I have now. But yeah, I'll definitely be checking out that website to see a little bit more about this. Because recently I've been mentioning that I've been playing with an elevation rotor to change the polarity of the antenna from horizontal to vertical. And trying to confirm there, trying to write it down, but I'm finding the biggest limitation is really my antenna itself. I certainly get a little bit more forward gain out of it, and hopefully a little bit better match, standard frequency.
Yeah, the question to recognize, you're trying to get the gain back of your antenna, and I guess what I was switching radios, I missed them. What is it you're changing, or where did you start from, and where your antenna goes to, Glenn?
The time is 11:46 p.m. Welcome to the W2EL repeater. Good evening.
Yeah, actually what I initially started to do with this antenna was I originally had a balance that was made by touch press on the antenna, and I tried running twin leads down from the antenna itself and tried to do remote tuning, which I found that killed the directivity of the antenna altogether, so really ruined the performance. So I figured the next step I've got to do is go back up on the antenna itself, put the balance back on the antenna, and then use the antenna analyzer while I've got the antenna up there on the roof, but where I can work with it a little bit and adjust everything, get the performance of the antenna back to where we're trying to, or hopefully do a little bit of fine-tuning to make it a little bit better.
What kind of an antenna, how many elements are we talking about? It had a balun on it, and why did you take the balun off?
I guess the original idea, which was a dumb one at the time, was to see if I can use the remote antenna tuner to basically tune the antenna with a twin lead, figuring I'd have lower warp in the feed line. So I pulled the balun off of the antenna, and it's a three-element MA5D touch craft antenna, which is a shortened 10 through 20-meter antenna that has coil, loading coils and passive cast on it.
What kind of twin lead did you use?
I was using the 400-ohm twin lead that Norm used for standard dipole.
What's the spacing between the wires of the twin lead?
Approximately 1 inch.
How many feet of that twin lead?
Roughly it was about 50 feet, and then I have a balun, a 4-to-1 balun, right where that twin lead comes into the house, and then I went back to 50-ohm coax into my antenna tuner.
Yeah, I'm seeing the complication that you added, and you did create some insertion loss. The November 2 Romeo something, give me the full call name, and what's your question, sir? My name is Dick.
Hi, good evening, Dick, KTORW. The caller is November 2 Romeo Alpha. Same as Eric, we're located up in White Plains, New York. We have a question in reference to earlier subject of a gain on a Yagi versus a miniaturized that boom, taking a smaller Yagi and trying to get the same boom, same gain out of a smaller size boom Yagi. There is a Yagi that I was curious about. Wanted to know what your thoughts on it was. It's called a or what's how they call TGF products makers of Xiangyi that electrically miniaturizes the Yangi, making a smaller groove and using smaller elements, using a method, I believe, of pipe pot loading. And watering they claim gains of the Yankees that have a much longer boom and longer elements, even elements that have been linear loaded. It doesn't seem to use any balance or anything like that. What are your thoughts behind that method of miniaturizing the length of a boom and claiming gains of a boom twice its size? Back to
KTRIW and 2RRA. Okay, Eric, I'm starting off very skeptical. If the guy has shrunk the boom down to half the size and tried to get it all back again by something he calls high pot loading, try to give me a couple of words on high pot loading. Is this a 10 meter antenna?
A negative. It is a multi-band antenna, five bander. It's a claim gain on 6 meters as well, but it uses 10, 15, 20, or 10, 12, 15, 17, and 20 meters. He explains it as a method of quad miniaturization, utilizing inductance and capacitance at the high potential points of the four-sided quad element. That's how he explains it. For example, I run a Force 12 C4S, and with Force 12, it basically it's a tri-band with a rotatable 40 meter element on it, but the 10, 15, 20 meter bands is basically a monobander for the exception of the 20 meter elements, but linear loaded to slightly reduce the size of a full size 20 meter element, and that's on a 12 foot boom. Great Yankee. That's definitely what best Yankee I've been using to date, as opposed to some of the Cushcraft and T-33s and long periodics that I've had in the past. But this guy has seemed to take claims the same gain in comparison to a Force 12, the one I have, and has shrunk it down to a boom length of like 7 feet. And the elements are a hell of a lot smaller. They use a type of capacitance tips, almost like the MA-5B, without the coil, just, capacitance heads at the end of the elements. And for his reflector, he uses the antenna looks more like a quench design, but the reflector is more of a quad or a web-type reflector in the rear. But that's how he explained it, the principle of end loading, something other, another full details, but he seemed to claim those gains half the size of my Force 12, and I would have thought that would have been the smallest that you could make a Yangi and still get good enough gains.
Okay, you told me he shrunk it down by 2 to 1 in size. You told me he's claiming the exact same gain, and you told me he shrunk the boom down to 7 feet. Does that mean the original boom was 14 feet long?
Well, there is no two versions. There's just the one version. Let's see here. I'll tell you right now. To give you a maybe a bit more idea of the specs. Okay, let's see here. The boom length is 4.5 feet. With element length of 11 foot 9 inches, operating band 6 through 20 meters. To give you an example, the lowest at 20 meters claimed 5 dB and 6 meters 6 dB. Lester height, that wouldn't really make much of a difference to tell you, but yeah, 4.5 foot on a boom, and that's only on the 2 element. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, on the 3 element, he's claiming a boom length of 10 foot 3 inches. Okay, so, about 12, about 2 feet shy of my Force 12.
Oh, way. Okay, now you're giving me, you're finally giving me some comparison numbers there. 10 feet 3 inches is the boom length on this trunk in Yankee, And the one, the other brand you're comparing it to, what is the length of that one? 12 feet?
Okay, well, to give you a full feet, okay, I'm comparing this, I have a 412, okay, basically it's a two-element monoband on each band, 10, 15, 20. That's on a 12-foot boom, and the element lengths are full-size to what it would be for a two-element Yagi. Here he has on his two-element version. I like to compare it to the two-element version because it's supposed to be particularly two elements on each band, okay? In the comparison, it shows a boom length of 4.5 feet, an element length of 11 feet 9 inches, and the gains are somewhat similar. The only difference is my Yagi on 17 and 12 is more of a rotatable dipole with a tuner. That's the only difference, but here he's able to make it on a 4.5 foot boom and a two element Yagi apparently on each band 6 through 20.
Okay, it gives me a lot of numbers mixed together. Don't discuss element length. I only want to know boom length of similar comparison. So if we're comparing two elements of brand A and two elements of brand B, tell me boom length of those. If we're talking about three elements of brand A and three elements of brand B, tell me boom length of those. I've heard mixtures of 12 feet 9 inches, 10 feet 3 inches, two elements, three elements, and I've got it all confused. Let me tell you what, element lengths don't matter. I can tell you, take any element length and I can electronically resonate it, and I can make Yagis out of it. That's some good news. I can also take two element Yagis because of the peculiarity in the way you do a inverse phasing to null out the back lobe. I'll admit you can do quite a bit of squeezing down on a two-element Yagi. When you get to a real, it's almost not a Yagi. That's a two-element interferometer. When you get to three elements, now you're really talking about a Yagi. And if now you want to shrink down the boom, you can't get the gain back with rare exception. And so, as I said, Gunter Hock, we've been studying it for most of a lifetime. You tell him the length of the boom. This equation will tell you what gain you're capable of doing, no matter how you stack the elements, no matter how long or short the elements are. You tell them the length of the boom, it tells you how much Yagi gain you're going to get. We're getting very close to when the time the machine's going to turn off. I'll back to you, Eric.
Hey, real quick, the Asian Center EDM product, the one I'm very skeptical about, has a boom length of 4.5 feet. B antenna, which is the Force 12, which has a boom length of 11 feet 10 inches, claims the same gain as the gentleman on TGM, from TGM. So A antenna is 4.5 foot boom length. B antenna is almost 12 feet.
Are those three elements or two elements?
The technical Force 12, okay, the Force 12 is six element tri-band. Okay, it's two elements per band. The A antenna, the TGM product, is two elements, and it is a six-band antenna.
I don't think I'm going to be able to give you an assessment, Eric. Too many things, too many bands. Too many combinations being compared. If I was a smart enough guy on HF antennas and I recognized the brand names you're talking about, maybe I'd be able to do something with this instrument. I'm a VHF, UHF person. I've used HF 10 years ago was the last time I was on HF. So I may not be able to answer your question, Eric, and I'm sorry. I don't have a basis for comparison. I can tell you the rules of the roles that I know about, and that is boom length is gain on a real three-element Yagi. Two elements, which is not a Yagi, you may call it a two-element Yagi. It's only a reflector and a director. It really is an interferometer. And you can do some...
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, WHCDO. You want me to leave the repeater on? I could make a change so it won't shut off at 12.
I've got to go to work tomorrow. I spent some wicked hours the previous 3 days. Thank you for the offer. I'm not going to take you up on it this time. Eric, we're going to have to leave you, and I'm sorry. And under the circumstances, I'm smart enough to know I can't help you right yet. I don't have enough raw data. Mel, we never did get to anybody in the mailbag, and I guess they're going to be a little unhappy with us. But still, we did some good antenna discussions tonight, in my opinion. And I think some of the concepts became a tiny bit...
Well,
I think some of the concepts became a tiny bit more of a...
All right, good night, Dave. WHCDL, I'll leave it the way it is.